Okay, we're beginning here on Mem Vav Amud Aleph, 8 lines down. Tanu Rabbanan, Vanashu Oto. So here it's talking about the case of Motzi Shem Ra, in an instance where we find that the husband was lying about the fact that Lo Matzah Betulim Lebitcha, that he was not telling the truth. Therefore, what is the result is Vanashu Oto Mea Kesef. They penalize him with a fine of 100 shekel kesef. Vinatanu La Vianara. And they are given to the father of this young girl because he was motzi shem ra. She is a wife for him. He cannot divorce her for the remainder of his life. So now, before that, in the pasuk preceding that, it says, and they will afflict him. So these are the punishments that the motzi shem ra is subjected to. Visru oto. They will afflict him, which we don't have as defined yet, and anshu oto. So those are the two punishments. So here the Braita says, Tanu Rabbanan, ve'anshu oto zemamon. That is the penalty, that is the monetary fine. V'yisru, they will afflict him, zemalkot. That is getting malkot lashes for this. Bishlama ve'anshu zemamon. The fact that ve'anshu, that penalty or penalizing him with a monetary fine, dichtiv, because it says explicitly, v'anashu oto mea kesef, v'natenu la v'anara. Ela v'yisru zemalkot, the fact that v'yisru represents getting lashes, minolan. How do you know that's the case? It just uses the generic term of affliction. How do we know that it means getting makot over here? Am Rabbi Bo, lamadnu yisru mi yisru, v'yisru mi ben, ben mi bin. So we have another one of these gezeirot shavot where it derives from multiple layers. Although in this case, unlike the ones we saw yesterday where Rashi was explicit about the fact that it was an asmachta derabonon be'alma, that simply was a rabbinic limud to give us a hint at this. Here it seems that it's more likely a real gezeirot shavah. And what the Gemara here is trying to establish is what is the meaning of the yisru? Because it's an unclear word, it's somewhat ambiguous, and we don't want it to be left that way, which is, yeah, we afflict him, that doesn't seem like a punishment or a directed punishment. So the Gemara is trying to establish what is the meaning of the word Yisru. So we know that it appears in other instances. Over here it appears and it says V'Yisru Oto. By Ben Soreru More, it also says V'Yisru Oto, that is the prelude to the death penalty for the ben soreru moreh is that first v'yisroto, that they do something to afflict him, and again, we're going to see that means lashes. So here we have, ki eliish ben soreru moreh nenu shomea v'kol aviv v'kol imo v'yisroto v'lo yishma lehem. And if he continues to defy their warnings after he has been penalized here there by malkot, then he's subject to the death penalty. So he's given lashes. And then, with the word v'yisru, obviously by the parsha of ben soreru moreh, appears with the word ben in it. And then we also know that the word ben, or bin, appears together with hakot ha-rasha. V'ya'im bin hakot ha-rasha. So therefore, we have here those multiple layers of gzera shava, which takes you from the yisru oto over here to the yisru oto by ben soreru moreh. By ben soreru moreh, you have the word ben. And over here you have the word Vayim bin Hikota Rasha. And therefore, we know that there Yisru Oto really means Malkot in this instance. That's how we know that we have Malkot over here, or that's the punishment of Malkot. So there are two parts to the punishment. There's the punishment of Malkot, as well as the fine. So Amar Rabbi Yabo, Azhara the Motzi Shemra Minalan. How do we know that there is a lav or a warning about saying Lashon Hara, or performing Motzi Shem Ra? Because here you have a punishment, but usually to affect a punishment, you need a lota say, you need a negative commandment or precept to tell you that. So Rabbi Elazar Omer, Milo Telech Rachil Be'amecha. We learn it out of Milo Telech Rachil, which Rashi quoted yesterday as being the source for Malkot, for Rabbi Yehuda, that the Lo Telech Rachil Be'amecha, according to Rashi, is actually the lav and the source of the Malkot, according to Rabbi Yehuda. Here, the Gemara seems to indicate that it's the warning, it's the azara, not to do this. V'yisru oto is the result of violating lo teleich rachil be'amecha. Rabbi Natan Omer, mi v'nishmarta mikol dovar ra. That one has to guard themselves from any evil. So each one of these presents, or each member, Rabbi Elazar presents it from Lo Telech Rachil, which is a person shouldn't be like a merchant that goes around. Here he's not trading in goods necessarily, he's trading in information. It's a person who gossips, a person who speaks about others. Lashon hara, motzi shem ra, person that is engaged in these activities, that's Lo Telech Rachil Be'amecha. So that's the warning. According to Rabbi Natan, it's Nishmartim, he called Davar Ra, that a person has to be careful from engaging in things that are evil, saying bad things, speaking falsely about other people. Rabbi Elazar, my time, alo amar mehai. He said, why doesn't Rabbi Elazar also use Rabbi Natan's source? Ha'omi ba'ile de Pinchas ben Yair. He needs that for the position of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. V'nishmartim, he called Davar Ra. Mikarn amar Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. From this, Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair learns out, Mishtar Tokora, Al Yeher Adam Beyom, Yavodi Dei Tuma Balayla. Person has to be careful not to have improper thoughts during the daytime, Yavodi Dei Tuma Balayla, because that could cause him to have a seminal emission in the evening or at night. So the person is influenced, as we know, that comes out in their dreams or comes out in their night, what they experience during the day. So if one of experience during the day is one of hirhurim, of these improper thoughts, then it's going to result in improper behavior or an improper result in the nighttime. So that's what it means, v'nishmartam mikol davar ra, is that a person has to separate themselves from those items that precipitate these problems. And therefore the hirhurim during the day, which precipitate the problem of keri balayla, a person has to stop those or take precaution against them. And that's what it is. Minishmarta mikol davara. Rabbi Natan, my time, alo amar mehai. So why didn't Rabbi Natan like Rabbi Elazar's source of lo telech rachil b'amecha? How was Zara the Beit Din? Because he has that as a limud to warn the Beit Din, shalei rach lezeh v'kasheh lezeh, that a person shouldn't be soft to this one and hard to the other one. Meaning that the Beit Din has to be equal-handed with both litigants. They can't favor one over the other, speak more gently to one over the other. And now, in terms of the meaning of lo telech rachil, over here they're dashing rachil to mean rach, to be soft, or to be soft-tongued towards that individual. And it's actually not so far-fetched in the psukim in Parshat Kiddushim, where lo telech rachil b'amecha is mentioned, is because the context in which it's mentioned. The pasuk before is lo tasu avel b'mishpat, lo tisa p'nei dal, v'lo tehadar p'nei gadol. Bitzedek tishpot amitecha. Then, lo telech rachil b'amecha, lo tamor odam reyecha, ani Hashem. So all the items preceding it, you have this problem in general in Parshat Kedoshim, Kiteitze, Mishpatim, where you're going through lists of lotase or mitzvot, that sometimes it's hard to see the connection between them. But over here, you have a list of items in the previous pasuk that deal with adjudication and the way that a judge should approach the litigants. Then lo telech rachil b'amecha as a continuation of that actually fits in contextually to mean what Rabbi Natan says over here, which is that the Beit Din should not be heavy-handed to one and light-handed on the other. Lo amar le'edim bo'u v'hiduni. If he did not instigate or propose to the edim that they come and testify on his behalf, v'hein me'edim oto me'lehen, and they testify on their own volition. Hu eno lokeh, ve'eno noteh me'aslaim. He does not get malkot, and he does not have to pay the penalty of 100 shekel kesef. He didn't initiate bringing the evidence in the case. His statement by itself is not enough to incriminate the woman. So now the question is, what does incriminate the woman over here? So seemingly, it is his engagement of the edim to come and testify on his behalf, and to testify falsely on his behalf. So if he engages the edim to testify falsely, then he is penalized for being motzi shemra. If he simply just shows up and says it, that's not enough to be called motzi shemra. He, vizomemea makdamim the beit haskila, we again saw this on yesterday's daf, that she and the edim zomemim, we rush them to the execution to be stoned. Mary asks again, he, vizomemeha sakadatcha, how could it be that she and the edim zomemim end up with a death penalty? Ella, ohi, ozomemeha makdamin lebeit haskila. The proper way to read that is not a vava chibur, which means and. It's not her and the edim zomemim, but rather her or the edim zomemim end up with a mita. And as we discussed yesterday in the daf, That is because if the Edim are telling the truth, then she's subject to the death penalty. If the Edim are found to be not telling the truth, but in a way that says, Imanu Aitim, to other Edim, say you are with us and you can't testify to this fact, then they disqualify the Edim and she won't die because now we don't have Edim to that effect. Again, yesterday I discussed there are possibilities of creating scenarios where they both will die. But the Gemara, on a simple basis, says that the two are mutually exclusive, and therefore it's either or rather than and. Taima delo amar luhu. That is because he didn't say anything to the Edim. Ha amar luhu, if he prompts them orally to come and testify on his behalf, essentially speak the untruth, then afagav delo agrinu, even though he did not hire them, then he is still culpable for the punishments of anshu otov yisru otov. That's against this position of Rabbi Yehuda. The Tanya, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Enu chayav ad shiskor edim. He's only chayav if he hires the edim. That he's actually paying them to come and testify falsely. My time mode, Rabbi Yehuda. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Yehuda? It says that it's not simply enough that he brings this false evidence. He prompts the edim to do it, but rather he hires the edim is what's necessary for him to be penalized. So Amar Rabbi Bo, Atya Sima Sima. We have Xer Shova Sima Sima. Tivacha Visamala Alilot Divarim. So that he plots against this girl. Viktivotam Loti Simun Alai Neshech. It says over there, do not charge interest. Malahalan Mamon. Just like over there we're talking about monies, metaltalim, non-real property. Afkan Mamon. So Tovir, we're talking about a monetary in exchange or a monetary plot. What is the monetary plot? That he hires a deem in order to testify falsely, similar to Neshech and Tarbit, which are interest that is charged on a loan or an mitaltalin. Now, what's interesting here is, and Tosafot makes it clear that he does not think that this is a Gzera Shava Gmura. This is not a full-fledged Gzera Shava, even though it looks like one, because of the nature of the questions the Gemara is about to ask. The Gemara says, "Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak v'chein Tanei Rav Yosef Tzidoni bei Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai." So we have this from Rav Nachman Yitzchak, and we also found it brought as a brayta, Rav Yosef Tzidoni in the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Atya Sima Sima, that same Gzeira Shava by Rabbi Yirmiya, Scharan Bikarka Mahu. If he hired them through paying them with real property, what is the din? Bipachot Mishave Pruta Mahu. If he hires them for less than a shaveh pruta, what is the din? Shnehem b'pruta. He hires both of them for a joint pruta, mahu. So he has a full pruta between them, but not each one will get less than a pruta. What is the din over here? All of these questions are basically saying, how serious is the gzera shava? Because by neshech and tarbit, by charging of interest, interest does not apply by real property. Interest does not apply by pachot mishaveh pruta. And so what the Gemara is asking is, when we take that din that we find by Neshek and Tarbit, which applies to Metaltalin, how much of that are we carrying over in this Gzeirah Shava? And that's why Tosafot says, it can't be a real Gzeirah Shava, because if it was a real Gzeirah Shava, none of these would be a question. It would simply be identical to what you have by charging of interest, which is, it's Metaltalin, and it has to be more than a Shave Pruta. The fact that the Gemara is willing to entertain these questions shows you that it's simply a limud or a smachta mid rabbanan, and the Gemara wants to know how far do we take that? Is it literally like it is by neshek tarbit, or is that just a framework? And then we look at this more carefully and say, oh, maybe even in these instances. That's why Tosafot suggests over here that maybe there is no real gzeirah shava. He also entertains an interesting possibility, which is that in certain instances where things are classified as real property, that maybe over there would be no interest. It would not be considered to be neshech or tabit. And so he comes up with an interesting scenario in which a person could technically be charging interest, but since he's doing it with real property, that it won't be classified or would not be restricted by the Torah's requirement of lo tisimun alav neshech. Bayi Rav Ashi, hotzi shemra al nisuim harishonim, mahu. If he's motzi shemra on the first marriage, what is the din? Al nisuei achiv, mahu. On the marriage of his brother, what is the din? Now, as far as the second one is concerned, we've actually already seen this and dealt with this question before in the Gemara in Yevamot, which is, if this woman fell b'yibum to him, and then he has nisuin with this woman, that nisuin Can he then make a claim, v'lo nimtza l'bitcha bitulim, that I did not find bitulim to this girl based on the marriage of his brother? Now, when it comes to yibum, we've spoken about this numerous times. You can have yibum from kiddushin, and you can have yibum from nisuin. So now, yibum from nisuin, in all likelihood, would not result in this case here, because if she had nisuin, consummated the marriage with the first brother, then she's no longer a bitula. And the fact that he finds that she's not a bitula is not surprising, because she had already consummated the marriage with the brother. On the other hand, if she became a yivama from kiddushin, then there's a possibility here that there could have been a problem of she had extramarital affair while she was in Arusa, while she was still with Kiddushin, and then he is the one who's consummated the marriage. He's the one who has Nisuin. And we've mentioned before, again, with a Yivama, that seemingly the process of Yibum is only Nisuin, not Erusin. The Erusin are generated by the first marriage, and the Nisuin here are generated by the second marriage, whether that's the replacement of Nisuin of the brother or the only Nisuin that took place. And can he make a claim of nonimtza lebitcha bitulim? So that's the second question, which is anusei achiv mahu. The first question about nisuim arishonim is unclear what that means. It seemingly means that he had a prior marriage to this woman. What type of marriage this prior marriage was, whether that was a marriage that was consummated, and then he divorces her, remarries her, and then in the second time makes a claim about the first marriage that lo matzati bitulim, or is this that the first marriage was only bikidushin, he divorced her in that kiddushin, then remarried her and had nisuin from the second marriage, and again, this second marriage is what generates the claim over here of lo matzati lebitcha bitulim, even though the erusin took place by the first marriage. So now the Gemara says, Pashut mi ochada, we can at least answer one of these two questions. The Tani Rabbi Yona, et biti natati liisha zeh. I gave my daughter over to this man. Zeh, v'lo li yavam. That's true to this individual, but not to the Yavam. So it's clear here that the Yavam cannot make a claim. This parsha of Motzi Shemra is not relevant to a Yavam with a Yavama, because the father's statement that I gave my daughter to this individual will no longer hold true. He gave it to his brother, not to this individual. She ends up with the brother because of the parsha of Yibum. So now, what's the story with the first case? Seemingly, the Gemara leaves this as unresolved, although the Rambam says that the Gemara also answered the first question. And it's not clear how the Rambam got that. Some claim it came out of the Yerushalmi. Others say that it depends on what you think the first case was. If we think the first case was a case where he had kiddushin with the woman, divorced her, and then married her again, it starts to look very similar to Yibum, which is that the Yibum was generated by a brother doing the kiddushin, and then the second brother generates the nisuin. So instead of being two parties over here, it's the same party, but there was one action that generated the kiddushin, and then a second action that generated the nisuin. Maybe you could parallel the cases, and therefore by paralleling the cases, you would come to an answer about the first case as well. Now the Gemara asks a question which should have been really asked yesterday, at the end of yesterday's daf, which is, my Rabbonon or my Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov? The Gemara yesterday suggested that the machlok between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim, or the Tanakam over there, was parallel to this machloka between the Rabbanan and Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov. Gemara never told us who the Rabbanan and Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov are. Here is their positions. The Tanya. Ketzad hotzeit shemra. What is the situation? How does a Motzi Shemra develop? Bala Beit Din. The husband shows up in Beit Din. Vamar Ploni. This individual says, Lo matzati lebitcha bitulim. I did not find your daughter to be a bitula. So he is claiming in Beit Din that this girl had an extramarital affair during the period of time of the Erusim. So he brings this claim against this girl. Im yesh edim shezinta tachtav. If he has witnesses to the fact or to establish that she did have this extramarital affair after Erusin, yesh la ketubah maneh. She gets a ketubah of 100 zuz. Im yesh edim shezinta tachtav, yesh la ketubah maneh. Mara says, what do you mean? They're edim that she had an extramarital affair. Why are we talking about a ketubah maneh? She gets nothing. Batskilahi. She's going for the death penalty in that case. There's no ketubah. There's no payment of money. This girl is subject to the death penalty. Hachi kamar. Im yesh edim shezinta tachtav, biskila. If they have edim that she had this extramarital affair after the point of erusin, then the result is skila. She'll be put to death. Zintami ikara. If the edim say that she had, well, there's no longer an extramarital affair, but a premarital affair, then in that instant, yesh lak tuba maneh. she has a ketubah b'maneh, because this is based on the position who says that if she represented that she was a bitulah and got 200 zuz in her ketubah, and we find out now that that wasn't the case, she gets 100 instead of 200. So that's according to that deya. So that's what it means. Nimsha sheshemra eino shemra. If we find out that his allegations are found to be untrue, loke, he gets malkot, venotein me'asela, and then he's fined with the 100 shekel kesef. Bein ba'al, bein lo ba'al. Doesn't matter whether the husband here had bi'ah with her or did not have bi'ah with her. Did he consummate the marriage or not? Irrespective of whether he had bi'ah, he can make the claim, lo matzati bitulim lebitcha. I did not find bitulim here. Belez ben Yaakov omer, lo nemru devarim elalu elokesh ba'al. This case is only true when he actually had bi'ah with her. So now the Gemara is going to explain the difference between Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov and the Chachamim. The basic idea between them is, how literally do we take what is written in the Psukim? Is what's written in the Psukim literally, or is what's written in the Psukim figurative in some way? So Bishlam, other Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, Hainu Dichtiv, then it says in the Pasuk, that after he takes this woman as a wife, Kikach Ish Isha, Uba Eleha Usneya. So now the Ba'ela, and then later on when he makes his claim and he says, Vekravela, Velo Matsatila Bitulim, in both those instances we can take it literally. Literally means that he had bi'ah with her. That Vayavo Eleha, Vekravela is a physical description of him engaging and consummating the marriage with this woman. That's the Pashtut of Pasuk. Elul Rabbanon, Mayuva Eleha Vekravela. The Rabbanon who say it doesn't matter if he had bi'ah with her or not, he can still make the claim. Then what does this language mean? So, ba'ilah ba'alilot. Ba'ilah means that he comes to her with a plot, with a scenario or a story. Ve'kravelah bidvarim. And then he approaches her with this allegation. So here he has these claims or allegations against her. It's not literally a physical approach to the woman, but rather his attempt at taking her to court and pointing the finger at her. Bishlam ala Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov ayinu dichtiv lo matzati lebitcha bitulim. He can make a definitive statement. I did not find your daughter to be a bitula. Why? Because he had bi'ah with her, and he says she wasn't a bitula. El Rabbanan, my lo matzati lebitcha bitulim. How could it be that he makes that claim if he didn't have bi'ah with her? Lo matzati lebitcha kisharei bitulim. I did not find people who give a stamp of approval to your daughter that she was a bitula. We do not have evidence of the fact that she's a bitula because I have edim, or I have information that she had this extramarital affair, and I don't find anybody else who's coming to undermine them or to reject that information. So I don't have anybody who is machshir or mikasher this woman. Bishlam other Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov anuktiv ve'ele bitule biti. Then when the father comes back and opens up the simla and the sheet and says, these are the bitulim of my daughter, then we can take that literally. Ela l'rabbonon, my, ela bitulei biti. So what are you going to say, that these are the bitulim of my daughter? They didn't have bi'ah. How can he prove anything about the bitulim of his daughter? So rather it means, ela kisharei bitulei biti. Again, not that he's bringing direct evidence, but he says, here are edim that can show that she was actually a bitula, or none of this happened, or he brings edim zomimim, whatever it is that he brings as evidence towards his daughter. Pishlam other Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov anu dichtiv. According to Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, it makes sense. Dechtevu parsu asimla. They open up the sheet. The sheet refers to the sheet that was used on the night of the consummation of the marriage, which has the dam bitulim on it, that the father keeps as evidence of the fact that his daughter was a bitula. So parsu asimla, literally, it means they open up the sheet and he can show evidence of the fact that she was a bitula. Hello, but your question is a fair question. I'll show you why in a second. Hello, Rabbanan, mayu parsu asimla. What is the meaning here of the father saying, that they opened up the sheet? There is no sheet over here because they never had bi'ah. They never consummated the marriage. So, Maribo, parsu mashisamla. They spread out what he accused her of. Now, some say that the word samla here means simla. It is the acronym for this word is, samla is simla. Now, Tosafot disagrees and says that's not the case. That the samla comes from the literary words in the psukim of v'inehu sam alilot devarim, and that's what the samla is. The samla is literally what's written in the psukim. Parsu et simla is much more figurative, which is We're going to clarify the situation. Opening up the sheet or bringing the sheet is just a figurative or euphemism for saying we're going to clarify this issue. Kidetanyo, Prasua Simlam, La Major Baim Bedim Shalze, Vedim Shalze, Borimita Davar, Kisimla Khadasha. So therefore we bring Edim here and Edim there, and we clarify the issue like a new sheet, meaning that we clear it up and we make sure that everything's clean. So that's the way that the Rabbanon are going to read it. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Omer, Dvarim Kichtavam. Rabbi Elazar learns the Parsha of Motzi Shemra literally, Simla Mamash. Simla, like a literal Simla, they take out the sheet. Now, Tosafot already asked the question, and from that it's pretty clear that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov cannot say literally. Because the bringing of the sheet is not sufficient evidence to do anything. Just because the father shows up with a sheet with dam on it, is first of all not enough proof to show that the claim is wrong. For instance, as Tosafot points out, you have Edim. Edim come along and say that she had an extramarital affair. And then the father says, no, she didn't. Here's the sheet with the bitulim on it. Here's the dam. That will not suffice to undermine the Edim. That's not enough to stop the legal procedure, which is of Edim, which is proper evidence, and the simla, which is simply possible evidence to the fact. Can't prove it's her simla. It can't prove it's her dam. You can't take it so literally. And that's what Tosafot says. Rather, it is something that is more figurative in nature, because otherwise, what is the point of bringing Edim? What's the point of the Prisata Simla? Tosafot says in the end that there is something, or there is some value about the Simla, but it's not about what we're thinking. It's not to exonerate the individual, the woman over here. Rather, the Prisata Simla is what generates the Knas, what generates the fine on the Motzi Shemra. And that is because he says, Vesh Lamar, the Savart Lo Mechayev and Mekain Heiz Panav, Lishnota Yadua. That part of the penalty here of Motzi Shemra has to do with the fact that this person is stubbornly making these accusations, even in the face of evidence to the contrary. Here the father shows up and says, I have a sheet with her bitulim, and he says, no, she didn't have bitulim. So his chutzpah, being Machzif Panav Domar, that it wasn't true, and she wasn't a bitula, that's what generates the penalties of Yisruoto Vanshuoto, because despite the evidence to the contrary, he still insists that she wasn't a bitula, and that is the problem of Motzi Shemra. So Tosafot says that the Simla actually plays a different role than we think. It's not substantial enough evidence to exonerate the woman, but it is enough evidence to incriminate the man if we have no evidence to the contrary. And if he keeps insisting on the fact that she wasn't a bitula, and we have evidence to the contrary, and we find a deem that proved that, then in that instance, he will be held accountable for that reason. You have to say in Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov also that he doesn't take it literally, because the evidence of the simla is not sufficient, and he agrees if there were a deem there, that she would be put to death, even in the face of the simla. So the only question between Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov and the Chachamim is, how literally do you take it? I mean, how much of the parsha, or how close to the literal reading of the psukim are you, versus the Chachamim, who are much more figurative. It has to do with the question of whether he has to have bi'ah with the woman or not in order to incriminate her. It also might relate to, on yesterday's daf, when the Gemara brought down Rava's statement about the uniqueness of Motzi Shemra, over there it says that the case there was of Motzi Shemra was a chidush, because lo niv'ala be'alma vizinta. In a case where she didn't have bi'ah, and then she had znot, or she previously had znot, depending on who's reading of the Gemara over there. But over there it says, v'lo nivala. She didn't have bia. There was a nisuin without bia. So Tosafot commented over there, the reason that they brought v'lo nivala is to accord with the position of the Chachamim over here, who say that even in the face of a marriage, nisuin, without a consummation, without bia, there still can be a claim of Motzi Shemra. Not that it wouldn't work the other way. If you had bia, it would also work. But there, the Gemara is discussing lo nivala based on this argument that we have here between Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov and the Chachamim, where the Chachamim say even without bi'ah, that's enough to incriminate and make a claim of lo matzati lebitcha bitulim. Shalach, Rabbi Yitzhak, bar Rabbi Yaakov, bar Giure, mishmeid Rabbi Yochanan. So it was sent from Rabbi Yitzhak, the son of Rabbi Yaakov, the son of Giure, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Af agav shalom etzinu b'cholot orakula. We find no differentiation between bia kedarka and bia shelo kedarka. That is borne out by the use of the pasuk of mishkevei isha, mishkevei in plural, b'shnei mishkevot divera katuv. That's whether it's bia kedarka, bia shelo kedarka. In all those instances, if it's with arayot, If it's any illicit relationship that the Torah forbids, whether it's kedarka or shlo kedarka, the person is held culpable for that. That is true, b'chol ha-Torah kula, of al-motzi shemra, chilek. By motzi shemra, there is actually a difference. Enu chayav ad shivol shlo kedarka, b'yotzi shemra kedarka. It's only chayav in an instance where her extramarital affair was even shlo kedarka, because that's subject to all the other rules of the Torah. A problematic relationship and illicit relations can be even shlo kedarka. So that is that she, after Erusin, had an extramarital affair, even shlo kedarka, that's enough to incriminate her. But the motzi shemra has to be kedarka. Keman, who's that like? Ike rabbanon, if it's like rabbanon, afagav delobal, why do you need biyah at all? He can make the claim without having biyah with the woman. The assumption being that the biyah kedarka is this individual making the claim, lo matzat lebitcha bitulim. How does he make that claim? He can only make that claim if he had biyah kedarka with her. So that's the understanding here, that his claim is only valid if he had biyah kedarka with her. Now, certainly the Chachamim don't think that, because even without biyah, he can make the claim. Ike Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, if you think it's like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, idi v'idi kedarka b'inan. Then in both instances, it has to be kedarka, because he is saying, dvarim kichtavam, that we take the psukim literally. So if he comes along and has biyah with her, and says, lo matzati lebitcha bitulim. Well, the only plausible explanation for lo matzati lebitcha bitulim is if someone else had biyah kedarka with her beforehand. If it was biyah shelo kedarka, he can't make a claim, lo matzati lebitcha bitulim, in the literal sense, because the two are not connected. So that's why it must be that it was kedarka in both instances. So who is this like? It's like neither of the two positions that we know. Ela shalach Rav Kahana mishmei de Rabbi Yochanan. Got an alternative version from Rav Kahana in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Enu chayav ad shivol kedarka, v'yotzi shemra kedarka. The only time that one is held culpable is in a case where the extramarital affair took place kedarka, and then the husband marries her and has biyah with her kedarka and makes the claim lo matzayt lebitcha bitulim. And certainly, of course, this is in the shita of Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov. Okay, next Mishnah. Ha'av zakai bibito. A father has rights in his daughter. Now over here, the Gemara doesn't clarify what these rights are, but from the examples that are brought in the Mishnah, it is rights both in the monetary sense, that he has rights in his daughter, as well as in the sense of control, of being able to determine the future of this girl, or who she marries. And therefore, the av zakai bibito means both in monetary sense and in a control or sense of as an adon, a master to her. Bikidusheha. So it's true by the case of kidushin. He's allowed to marry her to whomever he chooses. Bikesef, bishtar, ubibiya. In each of these instances, he is the beneficiary of the kidushin. So if he marries her off for kesef kidushin, he's entitled to the kesef kidushin. If he marries her off for a shtar, which is another methodology we know from the Mishnayot Kiddushin to marry her off, then he's entitled to keep the shtar. If he marries her off bibi'ah, which again we don't favor, we have Rav who says that he would give malkot to anybody who did this. It's not our favorite approach to creating Kiddushin, but it is a methodology that is both mina Torah and allowed as one of the three ways to perform Kiddushin. Then he has the right, as Rashi says over here, to give her over to whomever he chooses, that he can grant her the bi'ah to whomever he chooses. So over there, it's not a monetary claim or return that he's getting out of the kiddushin, but simply the right to be moser to whomever he wants, the bi'ah. Zakai b'mitziata, he is entitled to anything that she finds, that those monies or that property belongs to him. U'b'maseh yadeh, as well as her output. Ubafarat nidareah, he's able to nullify her nidarim. Again, here it's not a monetary, this is a right of quote-unquote control, that he's able to stop those nidarim. Umikabelet gita, he's able to receive her get. Ve'enu ochel peirot b'chayeha, he's not entitled to eat the output of a field that belongs to her. If she inherited a field from her mother, then the father is not entitled to the output of the field. What he does is he takes the output of the field and creates an escrow with that money for her. The Gemara calls a skula. Niseit, once she marries, yeter alav abal, the husband in a full-fledged marriage of nisuin has things that trump the father in his ability or ownership, quote-unquote, in his wife, which is shochel peirot b'chaya. If his wife has property that came through the ketubah that belongs to her, he's entitled to the output of that field. That's the nichsei melog that she brings into the marriage. He's entitled to the production of that field, and he doesn't have to keep it in escrow for her. V'chayav v'mizunoteha. He has to sustain her. He has to provide for her mizonot, ubirpirkona, and he's required to redeem her if she's taken into captivity, ukvurata, and he has to provide for her burial. At least part of them are exchanged to the fact that he actually inherits her. If she predeceases him, the husband inherits her, that inheritance then generates obligations on his half, which is that he has to bury her and take care of the burial. We saw that in the Gemara and Yevamot, because she becomes like a mate mitzvah. Since the family won't deal with her because they're not going to inherit her, the husband who inherits her has to take care of her burial. These are obligations on the husband. Some of these, again, come in exchange for the other items. The right to eat peirot generates his obligation then to redeem her. And then the kvura is in exchange for inheriting her. So each of these is quid pro quo for something that he gets from the woman. He provides this in exchange. But here, these are the husband's relationship with the wife is slightly different than the father's relationship. Something Shonim point out, it's not exact because there are things where the husband has rights, for instance, to nullify the wife's nidarim. Father also has the right to nullify the nidarim, but actually the father's power is greater. Father can nullify any type of neder, whereas, according to many, the husband can only nullify nidarim of inui nefesh. So even though we say that the husband over here has more power or is in greater relationship with the woman, nevertheless, it doesn't mean literally greater or more control over situations. It's rather that he has these additional items, but that doesn't mean it's not a comparison of qualitatively who has more rights in these instances or in each situation who has more rights. It's simply about the number of items that we're listing over here. Yehuda tells us, what does that mean? That he has to provide for a funeral. That is, even for the poorest amongst Bnei Yisrael, that he has to give her at least two flutes and mikononot. And those women that eulogize and cry on her behalf, I mean, that has to be a proper funeral procession. The minimum standard Rabbi Yehuda lays out over here. So now, mikesef minalan. How do we know that the father is entitled to the kesef kiddushin of the daughter? Amri Yehuda Merkra, the pasuk says, v'yatzachinah mein kosef. When it comes to Nama Ivriya, who reaches the age of Narot, it says over there that if the father had sold her as a Nama Ivriya, and she reaches the age of puberty, she goes free. When it goes free there, it says, v'yatzachinah ein kosef. Over there, when she goes free, then she goes free without any payment. Which says, v'im shlashelo yaselah. Right, if he doesn't do any one of these three items to her, one of the items is that he marries her. The other item is that his son marries her. The last of the items is that she either comes of age or she redeems herself. Then, if these three items don't take case, he's not allowed to sell her. He has to let her go. Chinam ein kosef. He has to release her, and there is no monetary exchange, or he gets no payment for the release of this woman, this ama ha'ivriya. Now, the Gemara is going to be midayek here, that ein kesef la don zeh, there is no money for this master, aval yesh kesef la don acher, but there is money for another master, and manu, who is this other master? Aviha, that is her father. So over there we say that the owner of the amar vriya has no entitlement to monies when she goes free, but on the other hand, when the father, quote-unquote, releases the girl. Over there, the Adon is releasing the girl from his auspices and she goes free. Over here, the father is releasing the girl from his auspices and then going out to marriage. So in the case of the Adon in Kasef, in the case where it's a master of the Amar Viya, he's not entitled to any payment. On the other hand, by the case of Kiddushin, there is entitlement to payment and the father gets the payment. Gemara says, Ve'ema l'dida, who says that it means to the father, maybe it means her. Maybe the father has the right to marry off, but she receives the kesef kiddushin. Where it says, hashta via mikabel kiddushia. We know that the father accepts the kiddushin on her behalf. Dikhtivet bitina tateli ishazeh. Because here by Motzi Shemra it says, I gave my daughter over to this individual, which means he's marrying her off. He's giving her hand in marriage. Ihi shakla kaspo. She should be able to take the money. It doesn't make sense that he can control who the marriage partner is. And then the money doesn't come to him. The mere fact that he has this control is indicative of the fact that he should be the recipient of the kesef. Gemara says, "Ve'ema hani milei ktana delayed layad." Maybe that's only true by a minor, where he's marrying her off. Then in that case, it makes sense that he's the recipient of the money because she doesn't really have the ability to acquire or accept exchange for her kiddushin. Ava nara di layad, nara that has a certain amount of independence where she has the ability to acquire on her own. That maybe she should be able to marry herself off as well as accept the kesef kiddushin. So maybe the two are correlated. Almost reversing what we said before. It's so obvious that if he can marry her off, that he gets the kesef kiddushin, maybe only in the cases where he gets the kesef kiddushin can he marry her off. What's that? That's when she's a minor. When she's already of age by Nera, maybe he is absolved of both things, which is that he doesn't have the ability to marry her off, and he doesn't receive the kesef kiddushin. Amar Kra, the pasuk says, bin ni'ureha beit avia, in her ni'urim, in her father's house. Koshevach ni'urim la'avia. All benefits, all rights of her being a ne'ara are granted to the father, go to the father. So we've actually seen this before. Vela'ad amar Rav Huna amar Rav. Then what are you going to do with this statement of Rav Huna amar Rav? Minayin shemaseh bat la'avia. How do we know that the production or the output of a daughter belongs to the father? She'emar, because it says, "Bimchoyim kor ishet bitoli ama," that a person is able to sell his daughter as an ama ivriya, ma ama maseyadel rabba, just like an ama ivriya, her output belongs to her master. Abat maseyadel avia, so too the daughter's output belongs to the father. Lamali, why do I need that limud at all? If all kol shevach niurim belongs to the father, then why do I need the pasuk about Amaha Ivriya teaching me that the output of the daughter belongs to the father? We know that already, that all the output belongs to the father. Now, by Amaha Ivriya, the reason that we see that the output belongs to the father is because his sale of the daughter to the other master is basically a present value of the output she's going to have over the next number of years until she becomes a Ne'ara. So his ability to sell her as an Amaha Ivriya is basically assessing the present value of the future output of this young girl. So if he can sell the future output in a present value sense, then he's also be entitled to that output. And that's why he is entitled to her output, is because he has the right to sell that output. If he can sell it, that means that he has entitlement to it. And that's the proof from Amaha Ivriya. So Gemara says, Tipuglei minureha beit avia. We should already be able to learn this out of Nureb beit avia. So why don't we learn that out from there? Why do we need this other limud to teach me that you're entitled to the output of this girl? And it could be, again, that this is arguing in the case of a ne'ara, where the output belongs to him. We should learn that out of Shevach Nura Beit Aviyah, not out of the Amaha Ivriyah. The pasuk of Nura Beit Aviyah is written by Nidarim. So let's learn from Nidarim to other places where the father has a relationship with the daughter. What's the nature of the relationship? Where it says, Mamona Misura lo yofina. You can't learn out monetary items from Isur. Nidarim is Isur. And we were talking about Mamon. You can't extrapolate a din by Isur to Mamon. Bechitema Nelif Miknasa. If you want to say, let's learn out of the Knas. It says by Motzi Shemra. It says by the case of Mi'anes. By Mifateh. It's Benatnula Avianara. That the money is, the knas, is paid to the father of the ne'ara. So you see, the father of the ne'ara is entitled to those payments. So there again, let's set that as a precedent for the fact that the father is entitled. Mamona miknasa lo yofinan. Again, you can't learn from knas to mamon. Knas in and itself is a chiddush. And since it's a chiddush, you can't extrapolate that to normal monetary matters. V'chiteima nelif mi boshet u'begam. What about the fact that boshet and begam belong to the father? Now this can be in one of two ways. Rashi over here says, mi boshet begam, is that the father is entitled to the payments of boshet begam. Others suggest that boshet begam is that the father has the right to marry off his daughter to whomever he chooses, and he can cause her that boshet in begam. So he has those rights. Those are monetary rights that he is entitled to, either because of the receiving of those monies from the me'anes or the mifateh, or because he's entitled to do that to his daughter. Shaini boshet begam de'avia nami shayach be. Boshet begam are different because the father is also relevant. According to Rashi, that means the father collects the money of the boshet begam because he has the right to marry her off to whomever he chooses and to send her off and be mevayeshur mifagamer. On the other hand, according to the other Rishonim, like the Ramban, who says that boshet begam, he is entitled to marry off to whomever he wants and cause her the boshet begam, is because Shani Boshe Begam Davian Ami Shayachba, because it reflects on the father as well. Boshe Begam is not just the Boshe Begam of the daughter, it's also the father himself. He also has a vested interest in the Boshe Begam, when the embarrassment of his daughter is also his embarrassment. The Begam of the daughter is also his Begam. It affects him directly. So there again, we can't extrapolate from there to Mamon. Ela Mistavro. Rather, we must learn it out from the case of the Amavriya, where it says that the Yitzachinam in Kosef, that we're going to learn out the Yitziah from the similar Yitziah. That what is the Yitziah that we're talking about there by the Amavriya? Yitziah Kavata. You can learn one of two ways. Rashi quotes, Anishamati, Yitziah Kavata Kamamayit, Mahatam Nara. Just like over there, we're talking about Anara. Afacha Nara. So too over here, we're talking about Anara. Just like that by the Amai Vriya, when she goes free, that is a time when she ages out, when she reaches the age of puberty. So too over here, Ni'ara, that we're talking about the father collecting the Kesef Kiddushin, that also is at the time that she is Anara. It says, Vikashali. I don't like that explanation. Akati Ema, Lidida. Because you can still say it goes to her. All that tells you by the case of the diuk, which we made out, that this Adon doesn't have money, but another Adon does have money, all that says is that the Kesef Kiddushin goes somewhere when she's in Ne'ara. Doesn't tell you where they go, it simply tells you that when she's in Ne'ara, they go somewhere. So where do they go? Maybe they go to her, not to him. So Rashi says that limud is not sufficient, and he rather quotes from the She'iltot Rav Chai Gaon, that Ma Kesef Titziat Adon, Iva Atam Kesef Adon, just like over there, if there was money paid, when the Amaria goes free, you know who that money belongs to? The master. So if she, first of all, buys her way out, then the money that he gets from her freedom belongs to the Adon. And in the case where the Torah says, V'yatzachinam ein kasef, who's it referencing? It's referencing the master. She goes free without any money. But if there was money, and the Torah had entitled you money, who would have gotten that money? The Adon. So too, by the case of the father, when we say that, that Adon doesn't get money, but another Adon does get money, who does the money go to? It doesn't go to the daughter, it goes to the Adon, it goes to the father, the one who's in control. So just like by the case of the Amar Avira, the recipient of the monies would be the Adon, so too, over here in our case, the recipient of the monies will be the father and not the daughter. So that's the way Rashi learns it. Tosafot brings down both interpretations and says that he agrees that Rashi's first interpretation is better, the one about this being the money's going to the Adon, although then he still says we're left open with the question of how do you know this applies to a Ne'ara? And Amai Vriya is really about a Ktana, not about a Ne'ara. And how we know there that the father is entitled to Kesem Kiddushin when she is a Ne'ara. So then he says, V'hashto, kevin d'shamin in mahaikra d'kaspa d'avia, havisvara d'hu inami mikabel. Basically, what we do is extrapolate over here, which is that once the Torah teaches us that the monies belong to the father, then it makes sense that he's also the recipient. Because how can it be that the father is receiving the monies and she will marry herself off? What Tosafot does is reverses the logic of the Gemara. The Gemara said before, how could it be that he controls marrying her off and he doesn't receive the money? Now once we've established that he's the recipient of the money, Tosafot says now we can use the logic in reverse. If he's the recipient of the money, then clearly he's the one who's marrying her off. And that's how we know by in the Ara, that if he's the recipient of the money, then he would also be the one marrying her off. And the father has that control, which is number one, bikidusheha, to accept kiddushin on our behalf. And if it's kesef kiddushin, he is the recipient of the kesef kiddushin. And we establish that over here. And we have different psukim that establish the father's rights in each of these cases. One is by the father's right to nullify the daughter's nidarim that we learn out from binura beit aviha, that the father has that right. The fact that the father has the right to the output of the daughter, we learn that out from the Kal V'chomer, from Amav Riyah. He's able to sell her forward value. He can actually keep that forward value and keep her output. The fact that by Knas, he receives it, that's explicit in the Pasuk. Boshe Begam, we also learn out from Ahekesh to Knas. And the fact that the father's entitled to the Kesef Kiddushin comes out of this limud of V'yatzachinam in Kasef, in Kesef Ladon Zev, Yesh Kesef Ladon Acher. From there we establish that it has to be similar to what it would have been by the master. And that means that the father over here is the entitled party of the kesef. Now the Gemara says, how can you do that? V'alo damyo. How can you actually over here compare the two cases of the Adon and the father? Ha yitziah la ha yitziah. How can you compare the two exits? Hotam gabi Adon nafkala mishutei ligamrei. When she exits the master over there, she goes now on her own reconnaissance. She is independent now. She is completely free. When the father over here releases her, he doesn't release her from his ownership over to the husband's ownership. It's not a complete transition. It's only a partial transition because there is erusin and then there is nisuin. So in the first stage, he releases her partly in the erusin and then only completely releases her in the nisuin. From nidarim, he can prove that she leaves his possession because the Mishnah in nidarim says, Nara mirasa viobala mefrim la nidara. That the father loses complete control over Afarat Nidareem, that shows you that she's leaving his auspices because she now needs the husband jointly to do this. So the Gemara from that proves that she's actually leaving his possession because he doesn't have the rights that he used to have. Right, so it's not a complete release, and that's what Tosafot asks over here. He says that there are other pieces of evidence. The Gemara brought this as one piece of evidence, but things like Truma. From Truma, from the father to the husband, there, midoraita, the transition happens at the time of Erusin. So we see there are a number of items that change at the point of Erusin, which already take this girl out of the father's auspices. Yes, it's not completely, but there are items within there that are completely released from the father, and that already shows you that there is enough relinquishment of control of the father to compare that to the case of the Adon and the Amaha Ivriya. If the father does the hafara and the baal doesn't, then it is a hafara. If the baal does hafara and the father does not agree, then it's not a hafara. Actually, it still favors the father more heavily in the case of nidarim. But seemingly what the Gemara is saying over here, and that's what Tosafot takes up, is that here's an example that at the point of erusin, there are a certain number of items that change. It's not simply erusin and then nisuin when everything changes. It's a process by which at erusin, there are certain items that cut over at that point in time. And one of those is a Farat Nidareem starts to cut over at that point. Right now, how about Shtar Ubiya Minolon? How do we know that he has the entitlement there? Amakra Vaitali Ishacher. And she will be to another man. Pasuk, and this is what we learned out in the Gemara in Kiddushin, is Itkush Havayod Lahadadi. Says that all types of marriage are connected together, and they all have the same din. So just like Kesef Kiddushin is a vehicle for marriage, so too Vaitali Ishacher, if she goes and has havaya and has kiddushin with another individual, those havayot is either kesh or shtar biyah, they're all equal. They're all equal means that the father is the recipient or the beneficiary in all of those instances. Zakai b'mitziata, he's entitled to her findings, mishumeva, because of hatred. Rashi over here claims the hatred is that if she does not give up her mitziot to the father, he won't support her. He's not obligated by the law, halacha, to support his daughter, provide mizonot to his daughter. So he's doing it voluntarily. If he voluntarily takes care of the daughter, and then she starts building up her own bank account, then he's going to feel a little bit of eva, animosity towards her, because here he is expending all the money, and then she's collecting things and not giving it to him. So that eva is what generates the problem over here, and that's why she has to give the mitziah. It's clear that this is a takanat chachamim, in order to facilitate that or prevent that problem of eva. So Rashi says that, Tosafot rejects it and shows that in many instances, even if the father is not zakai b'mitziata, he still provides mizonot. We see there's no correlation necessarily between those two items, and therefore the Tosafot says that the eva here is literally so that there isn't any animosity between the parties. They have a relationship here, and a certain nature of the relationship, and if she starts collecting or keeping her mitziata, that's going to generate a certain amount of eva in the relationship because she is acting, quote-unquote, independent. And since she's acting independent when in a relationship where supposedly the father is still in control of the situation, he can marry off to who he pleases. So if she irks her father or brings on his ire, he can marry her off to someone that she doesn't like or someone that's inappropriate. So the father has that control, and we don't want to generate that animosity because it will have a bad result in the father taking care of the daughter and marrying off to an appropriate individual. The better he feels about the daughter, the more likely he is to protect her and take care of those situations. So in order to engender a good will between them, the mitziatan goes to the father. Again, either because we don't want them quarreling, or because of the more important outcome is that he marries her off in a proper situation. Okay, we'll stop here on the top of Mzayin Omud Aleph.